Chief Justice Jefferson, and may it please the court. This is one of those happy occasions where this court can accomplish justice, adhere to precedent, exercise judicial restraint, and avoid a proliferation of lawsuits all in one case.
What about the do justice part? You didn't say that. Well, can we do that too?
That's the first one. That's the first one I want to talk about. You can do justice in this case by answering the question that the Fifth Circuit asked, no. Just to set the stage, of course, the Fifth Circuit has asked this court whether it wants to imply a duty in all insurance contracts for the insurance company to find and advise additional insurers, or perhaps omnibus insurers, of a potential right to coverage.
But assume you find the insurer, is it burdensome to advise the insurer?
Well, it may be burdensome if the insured won't answer letters.
No, I'm saying you found it. You're sitting in a room with them. You're the counsel for his or her employer. What's the burden to advising them that they're covered under this policy?
Well, first of all, if you're counsel for the employer, you're not the agent of the insurance company. But if you want to step out and give somebody who's not your client advice.
Okay, well, you're the insurance, you're the claims adjuster. You're in the same room. Everyone's there together. You represent the insurance. You're the insurance company's employee who is given the assignment of adjusting this claim. And you're in a room with the driver and the driver's employer. There's no question that the insurance covers both. What's the burden of the insurer saying, we insure you as well? To someone who's unsophisticated and knows nothing about policies that the employer may or may not have procured.
Well, it's not burdensome if you're in the same room. Of course, if you're in the same room, that means the additional insured has gone to some effort to meet with you and will meet with you, which is not what we have in this case. This would be a poor case to adopt a rule about what somebody ought to say to somebody who won't accept any communication.
At this point, I'm just talking about the case where the insurer is and the insured are together in the same room. There's been no problem finding them. What would be the policy reason not to require the insurer to advise, especially in these the cases where the insured are not sophisticated, don't know anything about insurance, but they're covered.
Well, under those facts, Your Honor, there's no particular burden and no policy reason not to say, well, of course, in that conversation, the insurance company ought to mention that. But the distinction is you can imply or infer that if the fella is meeting with you, he is asking for your help and wants some, you know, insurance company involvement in this case. That's not what we have here.
Well, what's the policy reason, as you said, policy reason, what's the policy reason not to do so?
Well, first of all, before this court starts changing contracts on the basis of public policy, I think the court ought to...
Well, you mentioned policy. I'm just responding to your comment.
Well, I was trying to respond to another question. Anyway, I wanted to talk about justice. Let me start over again a little bit by saying this case should not require National Union to pay this default judgment because it leaves everybody exactly where they ought to be. Mr. Morris bears personal responsibility for not filing an answer, not doing anything about his the summons that he got, which clearly told him what he needed to do. And so he's got a default judgment against him. The good news, bad news from his perspective is he doesn't have any money to pay that judgment anyway, so it's not going to be collected. Mrs. Crocker was injured, but the jury found she was not injured as a result of any negligence of this nursing home or of its employees. So under the law, she should not get a recovery. And National Union should not have to pay a default judgment entered against an insurer who never asked for coverage, who never sent the papers, who never made any contact, and indeed would not respond to contacts that were directed at him.
Well, typically, my guess is that most of the time the company gets sued because of an active employee, the company notifies the carrier, they come in and they answer for both. And you're saying that there's no duty to do that?
Not only if the employee won't send the papers and won't communicate, the insurance company has no authority to answer for him. This is an attorney-client relationship that is...
But it usually happens, wouldn't you say?
I don't know that it usually happens. I think what usually happens is the employer probably gets a little more proactive in trying to bring the employee in. Here, of course, the employee had been fired. But if you ask, you know, as between the insurance company, who doesn't know who the employees are to start out with, or the employer, who ought to tell these employees that they've got coverage, I think it ought to be the employer. Because if you create a rule that starts, requiring an insurance company to investigate and find out who all the potential omnibus insureds and potential additional insureds that may or usually are not named but might be named in the policy and advise them of potential coverage, there's no end to the litigation that's going to be spawned by that. Because then you have to decide, well, what knowledge on the insurance company's part is enough to trigger that? If somebody reads about a suit in the paper and so knows this person is probably an additional insured, or if somebody in the human relations department of the insurance company has a friend who knows, and then what kind of communication is going to be told, and if, does it have to be in writing? Does it have to be in English? Suppose they can't read? There are going to be innumerable questions that come up about this duty. And that's why Weaver says it best, and nothing has changed that ought to change the rule in Weaver. The rule in Weaver was reaffirmed by this court in the Harbaugh case. If
how does English play into your argument? There are no documents submitted by any insurance companies in the United States that aren't in any other language but English. I mean, how does that play into your argument?
If you look at the Fifth Circuit's question, you have to take reasonable steps to advise the insured. In this case, the insured, Mr. Morris, says he couldn't read very well. He could read for about 2 minutes, and then he'd set the piece of paper down because it gave him a headache because of a medical condition.
Not too many lay people that can read insurance policies the way they're stated as it is.
All right. Well, then, if that's true, if you adopt this duty and the insurance company sends the policy to the insured, then somebody's going to say, well, that wasn't enough. You need to explain it to them. That's what I'm saying. If you go down the road of creating this antecedent duty that before anybody says anything to the insurance company, they have to go out and find this person and make them understand that they've got a right to a defense, there'll be no end to the variation.
Well, once there's an attorney-client privilege, you have such a duty, no question about it.
Well,
once, if the guy had forwarded the papers, you would have had the duty, you know, to hire an attorney for him, or for the attorney to tell him, look, we need to answer him, we need to show up at the deposition, we need to do all this other stuff. So there's no question, if they'd sent the papers to you, you'd have all those duties.
Well,
to inform him no matter how stupid he was.
The attorney is going to have that duty. If the papers had been sent to the carrier would have hired an attorney, may have been the same attorney in this case, and the attorney would have answered for the person, and we wouldn't be here. Of course, if Mr. Morris had answered himself.
No, but we've got to push that back. But now, at this deposition, suppose the insurance adjuster representative and the attorney for the insurance, for the employer is sitting there and watches this person, their additional insured, be handed the papers, knows they're served, watches it happen. Do you have a duty then to speak up and say, you know, you're covered?
Well, I would say, you know, if this is a deposition and, you know, the plaintiff has noticed the deposition and the employer is there, I don't know that the insurance adjuster is going to be there. The problem that you have here is that the deposition is usually not attended by an insurance adjuster.
Well, the problem we have here is it's a policy that covers somebody and they don't know it.
Well, the other problem we have is the person doesn't care. He's got no money to pay a judgment anyway.
Two different questions. Not everybody may be as bad as this guy. And I'm, you know, the question for us, do we write a rule for bad guys or do we write a rule for everybody? Because bad guys is a very factual intensive rule.
Well.
But the question really certified to us is what do you do? What's your duties with respect to a policy where it's very unlikely the policyholder knows they are a policyholder?
Right. Well.
And there's got to be some duty there to do something, because otherwise there will never be any coverage there, right?
No. In the normal case, now what you're talking about is creating an abnormal rule for an abnormal situation that would not have changed the result here. Suppose that letter that was sent had said you might be covered. He doesn't receive the letter. He's not accepting certified mail. He doesn't read mail if he gets it. So it's not going to make any difference in this case. This is a poor case to try to impose and create as a matter of public policy some extra contractual duty. This, by the way, would have to be a contract duty to do Mrs. Crocker any good. And this court said in the Head case, we're not implying any more contract duties. The Stowers duty and the duties under the contract are enough to protect the insured. And I would go on to say the duties under the insurance code and the DTPA are enough to protect the insured.
Assuming that's true, what about question three?
Well,
and assume that your policy had a prejudice provision in it, which I understand your policy doesn't, but the policies Harwell and Cruz case did.
Right. If prejudice were required, the third question is whether notice of that the fellow had been served is enough to defeat prejudice as a matter of law. And the answer to that question has to be no, because of the same thing stated in Weaver.
Could it defeat it in as a matter of fact? Well, could it be enough if you tried that issue, was there prejudice? Could you find the lack of prejudice once you consider all of the facts?
Well, in a hypothetical case, yes. And some of the courts of appeals have dealt with that. Like that Allstate case. Well, the fellow, Mr. Pear, well, I think that was the plaintiff's name, but the insured went into Allstate two or three times and talked in person to the agent, and the agent said it's all been taken care of. Well, in that circumstance, the insurance company knows he's in there asking for their help about the suit.
So if it's not a question of law, but it could be a question of fact, and then I guess should it be implied in a policy that doesn't have it? Your view is no.
Well, my view is certainly no, that like this court said in Cutea, if you're going to start rewriting insurance policies, why don't we leave that to the Board of Insurance or the Insurance Department and the legislature, the bodies that are charged with that kind of thing. But in this case, the reason that prejudice, that the lack of prejudice is not established, and we think prejudice is established if it's required as a matter of law, is we had no authority to answer for him.
A survey of other states in the amicus, and you've got a few. Your opposing counsel mentioned Washington, New Jersey. Where does Texas stand in the nation with respect to whether there's a duty to notify, inform, and on prejudice?
To my reading, most of those cases have to do with a failure to cooperate after the suit papers have already been turned in, but then something else happens and the insurer disappears and whatever. In fact, that's the scenario in the case that is quoted in the Appleman treatise that the Fifth Circuit talks about. That sentence in Appleman has never been cited since. And so,
is it important at all that we try to bring ourselves in line with what's going around? What's happening nationally on these three questions or not?
I know that this court likes to take a look at that. The insurance industry in Texas is uniquely regulated, and I think the court needs to take that into account. And this court has a lot of its own precedent that controls this case. If this were a case where there's no controlling precedent, nothing else had been written, and this court wanted to step out, I could understand that. But I don't know of any court, any state, that imposes this antecedent duty to find an additional insurer, especially one who doesn't want to communicate with you like we have in this case, and advise them of their potential rights. This case is not a good case for the imposition of that. The other point that we've raised in our brief is that under no circumstances, like the court said in Gandy, should National Union be required to pay a default judgment, a judgment that's taken without an actual trial. I mean, and the answer we get is, well, there was an actual trial. Yes, there was an actual trial and a defense verdict. The defense verdict establishes that Mr. Morris was not negligent, and yet the trial judge, apparently, according to the colloquy that took place in front of Judge Ferguson, the state trial judge had already arranged this with the plaintiff's counsel. That's what the plaintiff counsel said to Judge Ferguson. We had talked about this. The judge says, well, let me hear the evidence, and then I'm going to give you a default judgment for $1 million, which just happens to be the amount of the policy. This isn't right. This case has all the earmarks of a setup. Defense counsel goes to the deposition. Mr. Morris is talking to plaintiff's counsel. Plaintiff's counsel then tells defense counsel, oh, he's called a lawyer and is waiting on a callback. Well, what's that designed to do? That's designed to stop him from trying to represent Mr. Morris. It's like if you're in an interrogation and you tell the police, I want a lawyer. They're supposed
to
stop.
But that can, I mean, that's a, I agree, that's always a risk. If you're, you've come, got to cover your employees, if you fire your employees, they're going to say, plaintiff may say, you know, if you fall over for us, we're not going to collect anything from you. And but we can take care of that on a non-cooperation clause, can't we?
Well, the non-cooperation clause doesn't even come into account until the fellow turns in the papers and asks for some sort of defense. So, you know, if
but
you
if
can,
we say, but if we if you said, you know, if you got somebody being as bad as you say he's being here. Even if you said, well, there's a duty to tell them, by the way, we'll cover you, you're entitled to this coverage as an additional insured, and they say, no, don't worry about it, I've cut a deal with the plaintiff's attorney, then even if you had the duty, you fulfilled your duty, you can still avoid the bad guy through non-cooperation.
Sure. If they come forward and confess that they've cut a deal.
Which they may arguably basically do by telling you, I don't want to talk to you, I'm only talking to the plaintiff's attorney.
Well, then, you know, that's
that looks a lot like non-cooperation to me.
Well, that's exactly what we have here, but that's what, you know, the case has taken a different turn because of the ruling in the federal court and the certification from the Fifth Circuit. But these questions basically have to be answered no if this court wants to stick with what it said in Weaver, which there's no good reason to change.
Are there other questions?
Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the appellee.
May it please the court, Mr. William Schmidt will present argument for the appellee.
May it please the court.
Counsel.
Initially, I'd like to briefly highlight some of the findings of the Fifth Circuit Court and the District Court in San Antonio, the Federal District Court, the trial court, to give some context to the issues that we're discussing. First of all, the appellee, Crocker, stands in the shoes of the insured, Richard Morris, the employee. Granted, there are two inconsistent judgments in the underlying litigation. But the issues in this litigation with National Union concern only the first judgment. The first judgment that was prior in time, which is the judgment of that Crocker has against Morris, the employee. It was also found that Morris was entitled to indemnity and a defense under the policy. This is undisputed. In fact, it's documented in the records of National Union.
Let me take you to the questions, if I might, and
yes,
ask you if there is a duty under question one, what is it?
Well, if there's any duty for cooperation, which is part of the policy, that duty cannot be exercised until the parties are aware of the benefits under the policy.
The Fifth Circuit wants to know from us, is there a duty? And I assume you think there is.
I do think there is, Your Honor.
And so I'm wondering what it looks like. What's the? When do you breach it? When does it kick in? How do you know when it applies? What does that duty, what would we say that duty was?
Well, initially I would have to say that the duty is to advise an uninformed insured that he has coverage under a particular policy. What just those benefits of rights, duties, and responsibilities that are spelled out in the insurance policy.
You would go through the policy, the insurer should go through the policy, see who the additional insureds are. Of course, there'd be omnibus insureds that you wouldn't even know about because they're not even identified. And then would you write them or call them?
I think the duty arises Certainly, at least by the time that the insurer is involved in a litigation with a particular insured. Yeah. I don't think there's any extra contractual duty to go notify all omnibus insureds, give them a copy of the policy.
Well, that's what I'm asking. The Fifth Circuit wants to know, is there a duty, and you think there is, and I just want to know what it looks like. Is there a duty to do that, or only if you're sitting in this deposition room with the person, or what is the duty?
I think once the unknown insured, an insured known to the insurer, becomes involved in a litigation, then the insurer is patently aware that the insurer is uninformed and has no idea about this policy, there is a duty then to inform that insured with whom you're involved in a litigation that there is coverage.
Before they're served or after they're served?
Well, certainly once the insurer becomes aware of service, there's the cases.
Because we've said in default judgment, you don't have any contact. Being aware of a lawsuit, naming somebody, doesn't mean you have to do a thing. Until you're served, you have absolutely no duty with regard to a pending lawsuit.
That's correct.
So your duty arises then when you find out that, you know, in this context, employer, the plaintiff has sued both the employer, which you're there representing, and the employee, and you learn that the employee has been sued, has been served. Then you have a duty to call them up, write them,
well,
tell them, we understand you've been served 6 months ago, and we haven't gotten any papers from you. Would you like to send the papers to us, or is that...
Well, of course, in this instance, the insurer had a copy of all the papers already because they were actively involved in the litigation representing the
But the defense says he never forwarded them. He never gave notice of the suit to them.
That's correct.
And so it's just, that's, in your view, that's purely a did you gain notice? And once they gain notice that he has the papers, in fact, he has insured has no duty to send the papers.
Well, certainly the insured has a duty not to confound or impede the ability of the insurer to represent him.
So when is it breached then? You've got a duty to inform. Is a certified letter enough that's never answered?
Well, the duty to inform, as far as the insurer, to inform the insurer, once the insurer becomes aware that they're insured, who is known to them to be a covered insured. Once they know he is in a litigation and they know where he is, they have, and they're involved in that same litigation, they certainly have a duty to.
So can they send a letter to the house, certified mail, and satisfy their duty that way? Would that satisfy their duty?
Well, I think the duty along with the definition of due diligence, depends on the particular facts and circumstances. In this particular case, because of a medical condition, he had trouble reading, so maybe that would not be a fair way to communicate to him. But I think the duty is to take reasonable efforts, and reasonable efforts should be dependent on the particular facts and circumstances. When the attorney hired by the insurer is sitting in the front yard having a conversation, granted under sworn testimony, but having a communication and conversation with the unaware insured.
Who's refused to meet with him?
Well,
whose client?
I disagree with that.
Your whose Honor. Client? Who does that lawyer owe a duty to?
Well, according to
is
national.
His client the insurance company or is his client the defendant company?
He owes duties to both. It's admitted by...
What kind of duty does he owe to the insurance company?
He owes a duty to keep them informed and apprised as to all the proceedings. They've admitted to that. National Union admits to that.
Of all the proceedings?
Of all the proceedings.
So he has like an adjuster's duty to report.
Exactly.
But insofar as making representations to anyone, he only has duties to his client.
Well, National Union takes a position that Mr. Morris was uncooperative because he didn't respond to our phone calls. These phone calls are being made by the same attorneys who are sitting in his front yard asking him questions. how can you have it both ways, that we're doing our responsibility to induce him to communicate with us, but then they don't want to communicate with him when they're sitting in his very presence?
Why isn't the duty on the employer to inform its employees that they're in a litigation and they need to cooperate because there's insurance for this type of loss? Why isn't the duty there?
Well, perhaps there is a duty, but there was no employer-employee relationship at the time this litigation was filed. He was fired shortly after the incident.
Well, it still seems to me, if you've got an employer who, I assume, paid for this premium to get coverage for itself and its employees, then it'd be much easier for the employer to say, look, you're fired because of whatever you did, but we have coverage for this. You need to cooperate with the insurance carrier, whomever it may be, the adjuster, the lawyer. That seems to me, if there is a duty, that the duty would lie there and not to the insurance carrier, who has to look up all these additional named insureds as the course of their investigation.
Well, I respectfully disagree. There may be scores or hundreds of omnibus or additional employees who are insured under the policy, but there's only one additional employee or insured omnibus who's involved in this litigation, where the coverage comes into play.
When the insurer got these suit, they had the suit papers, and they knew the employer was being sued and the employee, what could they have at that point, before contacting the insurer, answer for this omnibus insurer, before they had any contact with him?
No, I think they do have to get his permission, but you have to have communication. It's simple contract law, as this court stated in the 1994 case of Hernandez. Insurance policies are just contracts that are subject to the same rules of application and construction as any contract. And if there is an offer which is obligated to be made under an insurance policy, an offer to provide coverage at the expense of the insurer, then that offer has to be communicated. You cannot accept or decline an offer until it is communicated.
Well, I think that what we're struggling with, you say it's a contract, and their position, as I understand it, the contract doesn't say we have to go make this information known to an omnibus insured, even if they've sued. If they get sued, they have to bring it to us, and there's no coverage until they get the papers to us. Isn't that what we're arguing about here? And you're saying it seems to me like your statement just fits in with their position. Did I miss something in there?
Well, I'm not following your logic.
Did you say that the policy has a provision in there requiring the insurer to take some action before it receives the suit papers? Does the policy have any provision in there requiring the insurer to take any action to this omnibus insurer that's in this lawsuit before that insurer takes the paper or gets the papers to the insurance company?
Well, I think they have the duty to investigate the claim.
My question was, is there something in the policy that says that? Because we were talking about the policy you were talking about.
I don't think there's any specific provision.
There
in the
is
policy.
A specific provision saying before there's coverage, you have to get the papers to us. That is in there. So,
well,
are we not doing what counsel says we would be doing by adding to that policy? Or
no, I don't think so, Your Honor. Because as a contract, like any contract, governed by the rules of application of all contracts, there has to be a meeting of the minds. If Morris, the additional insured, is a party to that contract, he needs to be apprised of the conditions of the contract. He needs to be made aware of the contract.
And let me ask you about that. Were you the trial counsel for the plaintiff?
I was, Your Honor.
So, of course, one of the first things you asked for in the litigation was the policy.
That's correct.
And you knew Morris was covered.
That's correct.
When you met with him, did you tell him he was covered and they would supply him a defense?
I did not. He was an adversary, and I felt it inappropriate for me to advise him.
But you knew about non notice provisions and things like that, that there were things that if he didn't cooperate with the other side, you knew you weren't going to get any money out of him personally.
That was fairly apparent.
You knew the only way you were going to collect your $2 million or however much it was default judgment was with if that policy was enforceable, and you knew he had to give notice. Why didn't you tell him to give notice?
Again, because I was an adversary. I was an opponent.
Aren't you estopped? Aren't you estopped from saying they should have given him notice if you knew as many of the facts and knew what had to happen and kept silent?
I'm not a party to that contract.
I know, but you're acting for your client. I mean, you're blaming them for doing what you had all of the same facts and knew what had to happen, and in effect, by not telling them, invited them not to send them any kind of notice.
I'm not a party to the decision and thought processes of the insurer as to why they're not providing coverage.
If Mr. Morris, in this case, and maybe this was the case, didn't want to, it's not that he was not wanting to cooperate, he just didn't want anything to do with it. People want to come talk to him, so I don't want to talk to anybody. So he's not saying, I don't want to cooperate, but the effect of it is, if he doesn't, he just doesn't do anything. And so you run out of, run out of options there. So as a plaintiff lawyer, you say, well, I guess I'll just go, I've served him and he's not doing anything. I just defaulted.
Well, again, this is a man who is unsophisticated, who calls, he does make some effort. He calls an attorney.
Let's take the example of somebody who just doesn't want any involvement at all. So he doesn't do anything in default judgment states, but I'll sell you my judgment. You can go against the insurance company and claim that they should have answered for it. They should have covered it. Is that what's happening here?
That's not what's happening here. There is no Gandy assignment or collusion. And I think there is not a failure to cooperate on the part of Morris. He does attend his deposition. He does provide extensive testimony.
To follow up on Justice Brister's questions, if we were to answer these certified questions no, who would have an incentive to inform the unsophisticated and insured that they are covered under a policy as an omnibus insurer?
Well, as the plaintiff's attorney, I might have an incentive, but I don't think I have
to have a huge incentive.
Absolutely.
So nothing would prevent you. You may not have a duty to do it, but absolutely no duty to your client prevents you. Your duty to your client, in fact, encourages you to tell the guy to get coverage.
Well,
doesn't it?
I don't think that I can provide him with legal advice.
I'm not asking you to.
And advice concerning his coverage under a policy.
Are you doing your duty to your client suing Mr. what's his name?
Morris.
Individually, uninsured or insured? Which way is your client better off?
Well, obviously, if he had insurance, there.
So, in zealous advocacy for your client is to make sure this guy does.
Well, we didn't have information on a policy specifically whether or not it covered Morris because.
You didn't ask for the policy first thing. I thought that's what everybody does.
And we did get a copy of the policy, but. The policy was provided in response to questions as to what coverage was available for the employer, for emeritus, the entity. There was no response as to whether or not this policy covered the individual employee. And again, I'm not part of the thought processes of the insurance company.
Do you disagree that the jury's take nothing verdict covered both the employer and Mr. Morris, or only the employer?
Only the employer, because Mr. Morris, at that point in time, was no longer a part of the action. The trial took place with Morris unattending and part of the action all the way through the close of evidence. It was after the close of evidence and before the argument during the charge conference where I asked the court not to predicate the finding of damages on a negligence finding, because I said, Your Honor, as you know, I have a motion for default judgment pending, and this is my proof hearing. And I need damages established, notwithstanding the finding of negligence. And that's when the judge, it wasn't upon my motion, but that's when the judge, the trial judge, said, what I will do is I will grant you the default judgment. And based upon the evidence heard, already heard by the court, awarded damages in the amount of $1 million. And yes.
So Mr. Wright says the jury's defense verdict covered both employer and employee. You just flatly dispute that.
Well, the finding of negligence, which came after the default judgment, covers the actions of the employee. I stated it's an inconsistent verdict, but we're not here on comparing the two verdicts. We're here on collecting on this default judgment, which it was incurred because the National Union failed to come to the defense of its admitted, covered, insured.
Is there something different about the relationship between an insurer, liability insurer like this, and the omnibus insurer, that we should impose a duty beyond that expressly set out in the contract of insurance?
I think the duty arises out of basic contract law as set forth in the Hernandez case.
Okay, so your position is not that there's a special relationship. It's just basic, ordinary, everyday contract law that requires them to go and tell somebody else what their rights may be under the contract.
I think there's got to be an incident first, and certainly when there is a litigation, it's incumbent upon the insurer, the first step is to determine whether there's coverage. Was this done in the course and scope of the employment? Once they make that determination, which they did, specifically stated in their files, that Mr. LaMandola would represent Emeritus and Mr. Morris. And once that determination is made, you have a duty to make sure that the contract that they've received the benefit of, the premium, you have to make sure that that contract can be executed, and the only way it can be executed is for the insured to have knowledge of this policy, knowledge of the existence of his insurance company. He cannot communicate with an unknown entity.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
May it please the court. We now have another reason to answer these questions, no, and that is a reason put best, I think, by Justice Brister and Justice Jefferson. We need to incentivize everybody involved to not try to proceed in the state on default judgments. This court ought to abhor default judgments. Nobody likes it, not even in sports when, you know, some team can't show up or whatever. Default judgments ought to be the exception, and the reason that Mr. Schmidt, let me not attribute reasons to him personally, the reason a good plaintiff's lawyer might want to hedge his bets is because they know this case is difficult. They swore in their fee application that's in the record, and I know this court doesn't have much of the record, but they swore in their fee application that these kinds of cases are difficult because it's basically a slip and fall. And so by having Morris out there who hasn't answered and the possibility of taking a default, they have two ways, they think, to get at the insurance. One, if they can stick Emeritus. The other is go through this default. But if this court declines to impose this extra contractual duty on National Union, then the plaintiff's bar will be incentivized to make this person go get coverage, to say, look, send your papers in. I'll give you an envelope. I'm not giving you any legal advice, but here's the address. Send it to these people. Maybe something good will happen.
Now, Morris was an employee of this facility, correct?
Yes.
Why wouldn't a duty be on the company that paid for the premium to inform its employees of this coverage?
Well, I think it should be. Unfortunately, they're not in this lawsuit, but if you're going to step back and say who of all the people around ought to have this duty, they're the ones who know who their employees are. And they bought that insurance not just for their employees, of course. They want their employees covered because if their employee gets stuck, they're stuck under respondeat superior. So it's in their best interest to make sure that their employees are defended.
When you were asked about the rule among the around the states, what was the majority rule with regard to prejudice, you said that Texas insurance industry was uniquely regulated, which suggests that the majority rule shouldn't be that persuasive or influential, whatever it is. What are these unique regulations in Texas that relate here?
Well, I didn't understand the question to be talking specifically about prejudice, because there is developing majority rule about prejudice. Prejudice comes into play, though, after something has been triggered. Both this court and the Fifth Circuit have said many times, until the suit is served and forwarded to the insurance company, there's no duty at all. So if you're talking about prejudice, Your Honor, then we do have the board order. Now, the board order, though, in my view, A, doesn't apply to this policy because it was not delivered in Texas, and B, the board order, again, does not talk about this antecedent duty. The board order would talk about a situation where Morris turned his papers in late, and then we tried to defend against Morris on the basis of these notice provisions in the policy. That's not what happened here. Mrs. Crocker may stand in Morris's shoes for this suit, but she does not stand in his shoes to give notice to the insurance company of afterwards. And of course, Morris never gave any notice at all. So that's. But I'm saying that in this arena, the Texas Insurance Commission has some regulations that, you know, are out there that could have addressed this if they wanted to. And that's why I think this court ought to leave it up to the board, who can investigate all of this, who can take testimony about what happens in thousands of cases and decide if there ought to be some new policy provision imposed on insurance companies. And that way, you know, it wouldn't be this free-floating duty. It would be something they would require to be written into the policy so the insurance company can pick up the policy and see what their duties are.
Mr. Schmidt said the jury's defense verdict exonerates only the facility.
Well, I'm just reading the charge, Your Honor. The negligence question says, whose negligence, if any, or did the negligence, if any, of any of the following? And in this case, the jury said no as to both parties. And on Emeritus, it said Emeritus, including its agents acting within the scope of their employment. There wasn't anybody else at Emeritus who was accused of being anywhere near Mrs. Crocker or causing this. So that's why I say the verdict exonerated Mr. Morris, because his conduct was submitted to the jury even though his name wasn't.
Yeah, but that's after the fact. I mean, you're mixing apples and oranges. You got a default, and the reason for default because someone, for whatever reason, chose to ignore the lawsuit that brings him into the action. So that's the punishment.
Well, I don't believe it was after the fact. We have heard that. I believe what counsel is saying is the state court announced that he was going to give a default judgment. He did not sign the default judgment until after the verdict was returned. Now, of course, the judgment that was based on the take nothing judgment based on the verdict came after the default judgment. But by the time the default judgment was inked, they knew they had lost the case. And of course, if they had won the case, they wouldn't bother taking the default judgment. We ask this court to answer the questions certified no, and thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Wright. The cause is submitted. That concludes arguments for this morning, and the marshal will now adjourn.